So, just to give you all a little update, I was watching Bloomberg this morning. Bloomberg reported that as of this point, thanks to the effort of Doge, they've reduced government spending by $355 per American citizen. Not too bad. They're cutting out waste. That's a good thing. Zach.
Yes.
You agree? That's a good thing?
It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely a good thing. It's good for my paper.
Oh, absolutely. That's true. Oh, yeah. You're going to have fun with that.
Yeah, it's going to be a good thing.
Did you watch the press conference yesterday with Musk and Trump in the White House?
No, I know who about
it. One of the things that just like blew my mind is Musk mentioned they discovered that the Department of OMB, so it's Office of Management and Budget or something like that, the department that handles personnel retirements, they operate a limestone mine, and they have to bring every single federal employee that retires, all of their paperwork, hard copy paper, manila folders. They go 250 feet down below ground level to store all of these in rows and rows of bins with manila envelopes. The yeah. same way they've been doing it since 1947 or something like that. So because the process is so slow, only something like 5,000 federal employees can retire on any day. Because how long it takes to fill out all the paperwork and bring it down to the mines and find the right place. I mean, it's just insane. So, yeah, pay attention to what's going on. Take notes.
Yeah,
you'll have good stuff for your paper.
Sure.
All right, Elizabeth is not here. Cadence is, though. And Nick? Excellent.
I thought it was on YouTube now,
though,
right?
Well, oh, yeah. Gage. Excellent. Chime. Chris. Excellent. Eli is up front. Ernst is not here yet. You Rich?
Yep.
Very good. All right. So, we know that this group of guys, approximately 55 of them in Philadelphia, trying to create a better governmental system because under the Articles, the United States is on the verge of complete collapse. Obviously, and this should be obvious, which I said obviously about, we all have our opinions on things. We have our beliefs on things. And sometimes we are fully entrenched in our beliefs. And we're unwilling to give an inch. Results in conflict, arguments, division. These guys all had huge egos. They all were learned scholars on aspects of the law and history. And they are arguing every single moment about every little thing. But the moment they got the Great Compromise through, creating a legislative branch that is bicameral, giving something to the big states, the House of Representatives, and something to the small states, the Senate. That seemed to be what broke the logjam. The moment they did this, other compromises started being worked out. And ironically, the most important compromises had to do with financial matters, money. For example, there were a lot of tensions, not just between big and small states, but there were also tensions between the North and the South. The reason being, Southerners had completely agrarian economies. The southern states were producing agricultural commodities. And their income was dependent on exportation. They were terrified that the northerners and their desires to potentially use tariffs as a revenue stream would hurt their businesses. And by the way, their concerns were justified. If you remember, under the articles, there was proposals to start using tariffs. And there were many strong proponents in the Congress under the articles for such use, because there were a lot of new business developments in the North, including the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in our area, down in Woonsocket, by a guy by the name of Samuel Slater. So these Northerners basically said, you know, one of the best ways for the government to make money is let's just put tariffs. Let's protect domestically produced goods. But the problem is that if you put a tariff on one country, they're going to reciprocate. So the Southerners were not out of their mind. They were spot on. So the Northern delegates and the Southern delegates, and they argued and they bickered, but eventually they began hammering out deals where I would scratch your back, you would start scratching mine. For example.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So what year was this that tariffs were like introduced?
Tariffs were proposed as early as 1783.
Okay, okay.
But this is going on in 1787.
Gotcha.
All right. So, one of the big major compromises, which can be found in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5. Under the Constitution, Congress has the ability to impose duties and taxes on goods coming in. But, unlike any other country on earth at the time, the Constitution prevented the government from putting taxes on exports. Just FYI, in England, under the English mercantile system, you by law had to ship all your goods, no matter where in the empire you were, to England, where it would be taxed upon arrival. And then, if you put any good on the ship to leave, even if it was domestically produced, it'd be taxed again. Well, this compromise was kind of that balancing act. Let's see if we can protect Northern interests, but at the same time, we're not going to boost the prices of our exports, most of them agricultural commodities, so that way we can be competitive in a global market. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2. Because the Senate was equal representation amongst the states, they decided that it would be the Senate that would approve treaties. So if the president is going to make a trade agreement, it has to go to the Senate for ratification. But to make sure that the decision to bind us in relations with another country would be beneficial, they required it be a supermajority, two-thirds. With the intent that the Senate would actually say no if it was a bad deal. But because the Senate was kind of balanced between agricultural and industrial countries, again, this means in order for us to get bound to a treaty, one side or the other would have to give in. Good compromise. Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3. The Three-Fifths Clause, first proposed in the New Jersey Plan, submitted for consideration by, ironically, James Wilson of Pennsylvania. And why do I say that? Well, Pennsylvania was a free state. It was the only state in the Union where slavery was barred by law. So why on earth would a representative from a free state propose this? Here's the thing. This benefits both sides. Because, as I mentioned last class, in states like South Carolina, there were almost as many slaves as there were free people. If you were to count the slaves as one person for apportionment, for representation, the southern states would get more seats in the House of Representatives. So by cutting it down to 3/5, you're actually weakening the representation in the House of Representatives. Well, why on earth would the southern states agree to getting less representation? Well, the other aspect of the 3/5 clause is taxes. The Congress originally sent tax bills to the states based on population. So the states that had more people would be expected to pay more in taxes. So you're going to get less representation, but you're going to have to pay less taxes. Good for the South. The North got something, the South got something. Here's another interesting one. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 1. The slave trade, American participation in the slave trade, would be banned after the first 20 years of our country's history. 1808, it said in the Constitution, was the year that the slave trade would be banned. Who does this help? North or South?
North.
Why?
Their economy wasn't dependent on slavery.
You know where most of the shipping interests were in the United States? It was in the North. Most of the guys that had the ships, owned the ships, the merchants, were in the North. Who do you think were involved in the slave trade? Northerners. In fact, Newport, there used to be a big slave trade system, like house, warehouse, down in Newport, Rhode Island, believe it or not. Why would they give up their business, this revenue stream?
Are we putting aside the fact that it's morally reprehensible?
They didn't consider it morally. It was right. just a trading commodity. Yeah, no, it had nothing to do with morality. Any guess? What?
Taxes again?
No. Well, obviously the government.
They made them do it?
No. They're the ones who are making what the government's going to be. Think about it. You have a 20-year window, all right? If you know you have 20 years to do business, what are you going to do?
Do business for 20 years?
You're going to boost it into overdrive, and you're going to suck out every last coin you can. And what happens if the business after 20 years starts going up? What can they do?
Sell it.
No. What can you do to the Constitution?
Amend it.
You can amend it. This was a scheme by the Northerners. Because it's like, look, okay, there are people out there that don't like slavery, but again, we'll stay in the business for 20 years, but if business is booming, we'll amend it. And by the way, don't you think all the southern states are going to sign on to keep the slave trade going if it's booming? But what happens if it peters out? Which, by the way, believe it or not, that's what it was looking like in 1787. The importation of slaves was actually diminishing. The use of slave was actually diminishing. It was costing too much. So if slavery becomes unaffordable, the South won't care, and neither will the North. It was a good compromise. FYI, does anybody know the invention that was created in 1791 that made slavery in the United States actually profitable?
The cotton gin.
Very good. You know who invented that?
Elon
Whitney. Eli Whitney. Last question. Where was he born? Yeah, in the north, but where? In Massachusetts, okay. We're getting close. Anyone know what town in Massachusetts? What?
Worcester.
No, not Worcester. I know a lot of, amazingly, a lot of stuff was invented in Worcester. Hopkinton. Hopkinton, Massachusetts is where it came from. All right. So, was anyone 100% happy with these deals? No. But notice, to get this new government in place, they want something, they got to give something. And in the end, was anybody 100% satisfied? No, but it was better than what they had. The chaos under the Articles. There also were other significant compromises, including one that your humble professor was one of the most brilliant systems devised. What are we going to do for an executive branch? Well, under both the Virginia plan and the New Jersey plan, they did call for separation of powers. They did call for the creation of an executive. But what would it look like? How big would it be? Would it be a committee? And then once we decide how big is it, who is going to select the person to be in office? And how long are they going to be there for? Well, after debate, they decided making another committee would be stupid. Because all committees have a tendency to do to squabble. So they decided there should be one chief executive. And they called him the President of the United States, POTUS. How are we going to get the POTUS? Well, there were some who said, like was called for in the Virginia plan, it should be Congress who selects the person to be the chief executive. But there were some that said, no. The states should decide who is going to be the POTUS. You know, one of the weird things? They never said the people should decide the POTUS.
Right.
You know why? They viewed democracy as mob rule. Because how many people in our country actually knows what the President of the United States, constitutionally speaking, is supposed to do? Do any of you know, constitutionally speaking, the actual duties and powers of the President?
Absolutely not.
So if you don't know what this person's supposed to do, why are we going to let you vote for him?
In pure democracy is essentially mob rule.
It is. So that's one of the reasons why they're like, we're not going to let the people decide because people are dumb. So we'll let the intellectuals to learn. Again, remember, Plato's Res Publica, the enlightened philosopher kings, let the people who know decide. So then the debate shifted. All right, if we let the states do it, the states are probably only going to vote for somebody who's going to make promises to the states. That might not be good for the nation. But if we let the Congress decide, well, then the Congress essentially is going to be able to use the POTUS like a puppet. You're not going to have true separation of power. So they reached an impasse. Until they devised something that was brilliant. The Electoral College. And we'll talk about it more when we do elections and when we do the president, but I'm just going to fly through it real quickly. every single state, big or small, would have electors equal to their congressional delegation. Reps plus senators. That's how many electors each state got. Each state would be allowed to decide the rules on how the electors are selected. By the way, during the first presidential election, there was only two states that actually allowed people to vote for electors. The rest of the states, it was the state government that selected the electors. So there weren't even elections for the first president, in the sense that we have elections today. The electors would cast the ballots for who they thought would be the best man for the job. And I'm not being disparaging to women, but back then women were not allowed to vote. The person who got the most votes won. The person who got the second most votes came in second place. President, vice president. All right. Well, what happens if the electors were corrupt? Oh. Once they voted, the votes went to Congress. And Congress is supposed to vet the votes to make sure the electoral votes are legitimate. And if not, the Congress has the power to decertify the electors' votes. Which means then Congress, checks and balances, has the ability to pick somebody else.
Today, the system of checks and balances is still theoretically in place, but the problem is many states have passed laws that have basically watered down some of the checks along the way. Today, the people vote,
but you're not voting for the man or woman running for president, you're voting for the set of electors who are going to vote. So election day is in November, the electors vote in December, and then the votes are transmitted to Congress where they vote in January. The idea is that at any point, the turnout, the results, can be checked and balanced if corrupted. And by the way, that ultimately was what the big brouhaha was on January 6, 2021. There was a lot of dispute over the legitimacy of the election. So before the riot took place, Congress was actually going to go through and vet the electors and possibly call for a hold to investigate the claims of corruption or illegitimacy. But the riots disrupted all that, and Congress said, fuck it. And they just did the vote later in the night.
So we could have had a situation for the second time in our country's history where the vote of election would have been potentially changed by the Congress. Anyone know the first time it took place? 1876.
That was Benjamin Harrison. Harrison over Tillman.
Not the 1 month Harrison.
No, that was William Henry. This is Benjamin Harrison. Yeah, Harrison over Tillman.
It was interesting in retrospect looking at the, I saw a really good bar graph of the last four elections and the total number of votes. So what was it? Obama 2, Trump 1, Biden, and then Trump 2. And the Biden's is like way the heck higher, like 40 million votes more. And so there was can we just go back and look at what happened here? Where did this massive jump come from? More people than ever in history voted for Joe Biden ever.
Right.
He's ridiculously popular. Weird.
Yeah, I don't buy the conspiracy theories, but
just some statistical issues there. Somewhere.
Well, you know something? Historians went back and they looked into the 2000 election.
Yeah.
Before your time. And there was the claims that, oh, Bush stole the election. They went back and they actually investigated all of the ballots. And when they went through and counted all the ballots by hand, it turned out Bush actually got more votes than what was certified. So I'm hoping at some point, once all of the politics dies down, historians can go back and just find out if it was actually legitimate or not. Because if, and I talked about that in the beginning of the semester, if the people don't perceive the government is acting legitimately, then that's grounds for a revolution.
Yeah. So we have to have faith that the system is going to do what we trust it to do.
All right. We'll do more. I'll review the Electoral College, like I said, when we do the presidency, and we come back to elections. All right. The last major compromise was the judicial branch.
Virginia plan called for a federal court system. The New Jersey plan called for a Supreme Tribunal. Well, the problem is if you're going to do a whole court system, what is going to be the jurisdiction? Or what if you're going to have a single tribunal, how big is it going to be? How many members? What is its authority? What's its jurisdiction?
Well, coincidentally, this was one of the last items that they worked out.
And rather than making this convention go into October and November and December, they kind of scratched something together real quick and punted it.
The Constitution calls for the creation of the Supreme Court of the United States, the SCOTUS. But the exact jurisdiction of the Supreme Court is articulated in Article 3.
And when we do the courts, we'll go over what is the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. But if Congress decides there's a need for a federal court system, that's going to be up to Congress to decide. So the Constitution makes the SCOTUS, but if there's going to be anything else, that comes from Congress.
And to ensure that the federal justices will not be politicians, to ensure judicial independence,
they decided it would be best to give federal judges and justices life tenure based on good behavior. So what does this mean? The decisions by the Supreme Court are not popularity contests, but rather their decisions based upon the Constitution and the law.
Of course, the consequences of that is sometimes the court makes decisions that people don't like. But that's the whole point. Because just because you want something, does that mean it is legal or constitutional? Sometimes, but not always. So how do you make sure you have an impartial court system? Give them life tenure, make them so they don't have to answerable to anybody, and let them do their jobs.
Questions? All right. Well, in total, they debated for 3 months. And once all of the compromise were hammered out, they were assembled into a document. On Constitution Day, September 17th, they assembled for the last formal session of the convention, in which they voted on what they produced. The vote would basically be an agreement that this document would be sent to the Congress under the Articles. Well, there were 55 initial attendees. But during the debate, as I said previously, 14 of them got so angry, so frustrated, they left. Some didn't like giving the government more power. Some left because of personal reasons. Some because they couldn't stand the person sitting next to them. You know, 14 different men left, 14 different reasons. Now, what happened on that day? Again, the only record that we have is Madison's notes. Franklin wrote a speech to persuade the 39 remaining people, sorry, that's wrong, 41 remaining people to vote in favor of this document. But Dr. Franklin at this time was 81 years old and he himself was in poor health. So he wrote his own speech, but somebody else read it for him. In it, Franklin said a few famous lines. For instance, he said, and I quote, "I confess that there are several parts of this Constitution which I do not present approve, but I am not sure I shall never approve them. I don't like it now, but it may grow on me." Then he also argued for this new government. I quote, "I doubt too whether any other convention we can obtain may be able to make a better constitution. For when you assemble a number of men to have the advantage of their joint wisdom, you inevitably assemble with those men all of their prejudices, their passions, their errors of opinion, their local interests, and their selfish views. From such an assembly, can a perfect production ever be expected? No. He understood what had just happened. He understood that not everybody liked what was on paper. But he was completely blunt and honest. If we try doing it again, we might not even get this done. So at least on this, most of us agree. So let's go for it. Of the 41 who remained, 39 signed. All right. Who did not sign? George Mason, delegate from Pennsylvania. Why? Well, he feared that the Constitution would give rise to a monarchy. He was terrified by the executive power contained in the Constitution, particularly being commander-in-chief of the military. The other person who did not sign, Alexander Hamilton. He could not sign because New York sent 3 delegates. And under the rules, each delegation had to vote and there had to be a majority. Well, if 2 of the 3 left, he couldn't participate. So he recused himself. All right, once they were done, once they approved, once they signed, the delegates adjourned to a nearby city tavern to celebrate. But an interesting story comes with when they had went over to the bar to go do some drinking. According to the delegate from Maryland by the name of James McHenry, while Ben Franklin was walking down the street, he was confronted by a Mrs. Elizabeth Willing Powell. Miss Powell was a powerhouse in Philadelphia politics because she came from a wealthy merchant family. And her family frequently hosted those parties that all the rich and the well-to-do go to. So she was known around town. And her word could actually change the opinion of men. Well, apparently, she went up to Dr. Franklin and said, "Doctor, what kind of government have you given us?" And Franklin famously replied, "A republic, madame, if you can keep it." All right. So now we have this new frame of government. How are we going to get it into operation? Well, it has to be ratified. But there are problems with ratification. The first is the Constitution was illegal. By them making this document, it was a violation of the law of the land. Why? Well, very simple. In Article 13 of the Articles of Confederation, it states, and I quote, "The union shall be perpetual, nor shall any alteration at any time hereafter be made in any of them, unless such an alteration be agreed to in a Congress of the United States and be afterwards confirmed by the legislatures of every state." This was not made in the Congress. This was made by delegates sent by the states. And it called for approval by the people. Not the Congress, nor the states. That's called illegality. Plus, as I've said, and I want to hammer it home, at the time, there appeared more people were against it than for it. For instance, Patrick Henry, "Give me liberty or give me death," that guy. He feared that this new government would basically run rampant over the states and allow the new government to basically enslave the people. Others, John Lansing of New York, another famous founding father, he didn't like the idea of making a stronger national government. He argued repeatedly, the reason why we made the Articles is to have a weak national government. We rebelled against a strong government. Why do we want another one? Edmund Randolph, who was involved in proposing the Virginia Plan, he was opposed to it. He said there needed to be more checks and balances. There weren't enough. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, he argued this is flawed because there's no bills of rights. Open up our Constitution. Our Constitution is the oldest continuously operating constitution in the world. The whole first part is our Bill of Rights for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Others, like Caleb Strong of Massachusetts, he hated the Electoral College. He believed that the people should have no say. He wanted to see the POTUS elected by the Congress. And Samuel Adams was the exact opposite. He hated the Electoral College, and he thought that the POTUS should be selected by the states. So everything that was agreed to, everything that was compromised, there were people completely against it. So how the hell are you going to get this thing done? Well, you had to campaign for it. You had to go out and you had to persuade people to approve this document. The group doing this were commonly referred to as the Federalists. They were not a political party, but rather these were the guys that were going around and arguing on behalf of the federal constitution. The most prominent, James Madison, John Jay, Alexander Hamilton. They made their arguments by sending letters to newspapers, by printing pamphlets that were circulated around town. The most famous of their essays, today you can buy a book called The Federalist Papers. That's my go-to source. That's always my go. You want to know what the Constitution means? You look to The Federalist Papers. 85 essays written by Madison, Jay, and Hamilton. Anonymously. They didn't put their names to it. Now, of the Federalist Papers, I've cited a couple of times Federalist Paper number 10. Another big one that you should read at some point is Federalist number 51. Federalist 10 argues why the Constitution was needed, and Federalist 51 talks about how the checks and balances would protect the rights of the states and the people. I'm pretty sure they're in the index of your book. Most U.S. government political science books have 10 and 51 in there. But if not, do a Google search. Now, similarly, there were people opposed to the Constitution. And they are referred to as anti-federalists. Again, not a political party. These are just the people that were against it. The most prominent, George Mason, Patrick Henry, Samuel Adams. The problem that the anti-federalists had, though, was because they had so many complaints about the Constitution, is that in their letters and their pamphlets, their efforts were fragmented. So you could get three anti-federalist pamphlets. One would argue against, say, the Electoral College, arguing it should be the states. But then you pick up another pamphlet, and then you have argument against the Electoral College, say, no, it should be by the Congress. And then you could pick up a third that didn't like it, period, and said we should anoint a king. So great, you're going against it, but if you don't even have a single argument against a particular part, people aren't going to be able to follow you. They're going to tune out. The success of the Federalists, particularly the Big Three, they all coordinated with one another. They never talked against each other's arguments, but rather they built upon one. Step by step by step by step. Plus, a few of the anti-federalists completely undermine their own arguments by basically saying, it's so bad, we should keep the articles. Don't even change the articles, which nobody agreed with. But they did have a couple arguments in common. One of the biggest criticisms was that there was no Bill of Rights, which essentially means the federal government could come down and mess with us. That they could take our lives, our liberties, our property. Now, Hamilton did try countering this argument in Federalist 84. And I get what he's saying. He basically says the reason why we didn't make a Bill of Rights is there's no need for a Bill of Rights. Because the Constitution itself is a Bill of Rights. Because in it, we clearly state only what the government can do. If the government is not allowed to do something in this document, they can't do it. So, he basically argued the best way to protect all the people is to create a government of limited power. and make sure those checks and balances are maintained. Then you won't be concerned.
Who argued that?
Hamilton. 84. They also, almost all of the Anti-Federalists agreed, that by creating this new government, the individual sovereignty of the states, which at the time were viewed as independent countries, would be destroyed by the federal government. And ironically, they were prophetic in this. They got this one right. They said the federal government would take power by using the federal courts. They would overrule state rulings, impose federal will. They also argued that we would end up with an imperialist president, particularly if you let the people vote for him. Because to win, what will the candidate do? Promise the people anything to get into office. And they were also terrified of a Congress that only worried about national issues, that ignored the states and the people. All of which are true today. So they were right in that regard. All right. As they were arguing, in order to get this new government in place, it had to follow the system that was actually articulated in the Constitution, found in Article 7. The ratification process was straightforward. There had to be conventions of the states. So the state government wouldn't decide, but the state would call a convention, delegates from all of the towns, to gather and decide. In order for the Constitution to go in effect, it took 9 out of the 13 to approve. So a supermajority. The moment you hit that magic number 9, you could call for elections. And you could go forward with the formation of this new government. Anybody know the first state to ratify it? Which is why it's nicknamed the Constitution State?
Pennsylvania.
Not Pennsylvania, not Massachusetts.
New York.
Not New York.
New Jersey?
Not New Jersey, close.
New Hampshire.
Not New Hampshire.
Maryland.
Whoa. What in the back?
Maryland.
No.
Oh, Delaware.
There you go, Delaware. Delaware is the first state to ratify. They ratified it in December 1787, almost right out of the gates. The fifth state was Connecticut. They approved it on January 8th. So in the matter of the month, five states. Yes. But then Massachusetts was up. In Boston, beginning on January 9th, 1788, the convention met. There were 370 delegates sent by the towns. Of those 370, 355 voted. Massachusetts was an anti-federalist state. The majority of the delegates were anti-federalists. And the delegates had many issues, and they weren't afraid to share their disagreements. There's actually a book that covers the convention. I have it in my library somewhere. Well, by a week into the convention, nobody believed Massachusetts would pass it. And remember, Massachusetts was one of the big three states. If Massachusetts didn't pass it, there would be no way that like New York or New Hampshire or maybe even Virginia would pass it. Well, interestingly enough, two prominent anti-federalists, Samuel Adams and John Hancock, devised a way to figure out a compromise so that way we could give what some of the anti-federalists want to get it done. Massachusetts attached to its response a series of proposed amendments, basically saying our vote is contingent upon approval of these amendments. Well, what was in it? Some of the notions that are in our current Bill of Rights. Ideas that were found in our state constitution. The right for you to be religious. The right to have a free press. The right to have secured property. The right to keep and bear arms. They basically said, if we can get those done, then we'll be in favor of it.
Were they against all those things?
No, they wanted them.
Like the other side?
The other side really wasn't against those, but they didn't see that as being necessary
okay.
to pass the Constitution.
Which made it an easy compromise, right? Because if they weren't really against it, then they didn't have a problem.
Exactly, exactly. But even then, that was almost not enough. So, Adams and Hancock, along with 15 other of the prominent anti-federalists, decided to not show up on the day of the vote. Because the people in the crowd would look to them, and they would vote exactly how they did. And they didn't want to be accused of being hypocrites, of compromising on their anti-federalist principles. So they conveniently were absent. So the remaining delegates basically voted. And as it turned out, by sheer luck, 187 to 168, the convention passed it. We're going to ratify the Constitution with our proposals for amendments. The moment Massachusetts did it, every other state afterwards did the same thing. Basically letting this new government know the states demanded a Bill of Rights. And by the way, the Federalists promised one of the first actions of the first Congress would be to hammer out Bill of Rights amendments and send it to the states. In the end, the ninth state to ratify was New Hampshire. They ratified it on June 21st, 1788. At that point, they called for elections, which would take place in the fall. After New Hampshire, two other states ratified it, bringing the total up to 11. But here's one last little interesting factoid. Two of the 13 did not ratify the Constitution. North Carolina. They would eventually ratify it in November 21st, 1789, a year after it went into effect. Why? Well, they met, they drafted proposals for amendments, but they refused to ratify the Constitution until the Congress fulfilled its promises. Until Congress drafted proposals for amendments. So once the 12 proposals went out, North Carolina signed on. Rhode Island was the holdout. Rhode Island didn't enter the Union until May 29th, 1790. Why? Simple. They were an anti-federalist state. And they refused to ratify the Constitution until the Bill of Rights was in place. They weren't going to come in and risk it. Woo-hoo. We get a Constitution. Questions? All right, here's where it's going to get complicated.
the design.
The Constitution is huge. Have any of you ever read it?
Yeah.
Took you days to get through it, right?
Yeah. It was a while ago, so my reading wasn't quite at the level that it is now. But yeah, it's a pretty long document.
Yeah, but it's like multi-volume books, right?
No, it's just a page.
4,593 words from beginning to end. That's how long the U.S. Constitution is. I've written papers longer than that. I'm sure some of you have too. The framework is built upon Montesquieu's argument for the need for separation of powers. Article 1 creates and defines the legislative branch. Article 2 creates and defines the executive branch. Article 3 creates and defines the judicial branch. Each one has spheres of authority. But it's not rigid. It's not rigid. There are parts of the system that intentionally overlap. The overlapping areas are what we call checks and balances. So, for instance, the most common used example of checks and balances is the legislative process. A bill gets proposed in one chamber of Congress, and then it gets debated on, and then it gets voted on, and if it gets approved, then it goes to the other chamber where they debate on it, and then they vote on it. The only way for the bill to pass Congress if both chambers agree. If they don't agree, the bill is dead. If they do agree, they then send the bill to the president, where the president can sign it or veto it. Well, vetoing is not a dead deal. It's called a qualified negative veto. The president just simply says, I don't like the law because of. Well, it then can go back to Congress. And if both chambers agree by a two-thirds vote, it becomes law without the president's signature. But what happens if the bill is really bad? Well, it could result in litigation that gets all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court could declare it unconstitutional. Could kill the bill. Kill the law. But here's the thing. What happens if the Supreme Court is corrupt? The Congress has impeachment power. They can accuse an individual justice of wrongdoing. The House will impeach them by a majority vote, and then it goes to the Senate for a trial. And if two-thirds of the senators believe that the Supreme Court is bad, then the justice is removed from office, just like the president. All of these overlapping areas, checks and balances, to make sure one branch doesn't take control of the whole system. Sorry, we have these 75-minute classes, but the timer sometimes only works for an hour. Come on. But don't forget, each branch is separate. Politically speaking, they are separate. The House is filled with members directly elected by the people in each state that's divided up into districts every 2 years. Under the original Constitution, the state governments selected the senators and sent them to the government for 6-year terms. Although today we now have direct elections for senators. And we already went through the Electoral College. Checks and balances, checks and balances, checks and balances. And as far as the judges, the president nominates, but ultimately it's up to the Senate to give advice and consent. So every man and woman who is in the federal judiciary, nominated by the president, but put there by the Senate. Why did they do this? Well, they looked at what was also going on in the world, and they didn't like it. Take, for instance, the British parliamentary system. In the British parliamentary system, you have parliament that essentially controls the whole thing, the whole rigmarole. In particular, the House of Commons. The House of Commons, the people, the delegates, the MPs as they're called, members of parliament, they're elected by the people, but the House of Commons decides who is going to be the executive, the prime minister, and all of the ministers. But the person chosen to be prime minister has to be ratified by the king. The job of the House of Commons is to make the laws. The job of the prime minister is to enforce the laws. But the crown gets to appoint the House of Lords. And in order for a bill to become a law, the House of Lords has to approve. But the House of Lords serve as long as the king wants them there. And there is a judiciary branch in England, but all of the judges are appointed by the House of Commons. Signed off by the House of Lords. They don't have life tenure. They serve terms. So, ultimately, it's very rare that the British courts goes against the will of the House of Commons. Well, this essentially means in this system, it's this one body right here that pretty much controls the whole show. And the Founding Fathers are like, we don't want to give all the power to one branch. Because what happens if that branch becomes corrupt? Ironically, what they were trying to do is make a government that worked. And they were doing this because they realized what they had under the Articles did not work. So what is the purpose of having a government that doesn't serve the needs of the people?
None.
100%. So, they scrapped it and created something that was streamlined, narrowly tailored, and assigned specific roles. To do only what it needed to do, no more. Questions? This is from your book, too, I'm pretty sure. The outline of the Constitution is pretty straightforward. It's based on creating a federal republic in which the national government has final say on all matters that it has jurisdiction over. The U.S. Constitution and any laws passed thereunder are regarded as the supreme law of the land. How do I know that? Article 6, Clause 2, the Supremacy Clause. The idea suggested by Patterson in the New Jersey Plan. Supremacy Clause. Thus, the states cannot interfere with the operation of federal programs. Because if the federal government passes a law, passes a treaty, there's a Supreme Court ruling, all of those underneath the system, the states, the counties, the cities and towns, must adhere to federal law. They also sought to limit state power. in Article 1, Section 10. Article 1, Section 10. To keep the states in their place, the states, for example, actually they're down here. Oh wait, that's powers denied. Powers denied. The states can no longer tax imports or exports. So no more trade wars between the states. You know, that was suggested at the Mount Vernon Conference. The states are not allowed to make money. There's only going to be a national currency. So you get a U.S. dollar and it's good anywhere in the United States. The states are not allowed to enter into treaties. By the way, these are in your book. States can't enter treaties. Treaties is the domain of the government, U.S. government. States are not allowed to interfere with contracts. If you make a contract, any type of contract, the federal government will enforce that contract, not the states. The states cannot interfere. And the states cannot interfere with the privileges and immunities of citizens of any state, nor can they deny due process or equal protection. Easy example. If you live in Massachusetts and you get a driver's license and you have an automobile and you get on a car and you drive down the road, go down the Mass Pike, and you hit the end of the Mass Pike and enter into New York, you are allowed to continue driving. Why? Well, New York recognizes Massachusetts licenses and the right of Massachusetts citizens to operate automobiles on roads. New York can't say, oh, you're from Massachusetts, too bad, you can't come in. We're going to take your car. Under the Articles, everything was chaos. As I said, the states were on the verge of going to war with one another. So what did these two things do? The U.S. government's going to be the dad, and he's going to keep all the kids in line. Now, of course, in the years since, the Supreme Court has also made rulings that have reduced the state's powers. But we'll talk about some of those when we get to the judiciary branch. But for those of you who are criminal justice majors, what's Miranda? Is it?
It's jurisprudence from the Miranda case, right? Where?
Which, what are all arresting officers, no matter where in the country they are, what are they required to do?
Read the medical records.
Well,
arresting.
Yeah, exactly.
To inform them of
what, so that they're not self-incriminating.
Right. To avoid self-incrimination. So the U.S. Supreme Court made a decision, and it applies to all states, all towns, all jurisdictions. All right, questions?
Yeah. Do you believe that when, like, you know how some people be like, I don't drive, I'm traveling, and when police pull them over, for them, the whole sovereign citizen type look, like, if people say that you don't need a license to drive because technically you're not driving, you're traveling, what's your output on that, what's your intake on that? Do you
having a driver's license is regarded as a privilege under the law, it's not a right. You have a right to own an automobile, but you don't have a right to travel on state roads in a vehicle not authorized by the government. So you could travel in your driveway if you wanted to.
Okay.
But the moment you go on to state property or town property, you have to adhere to all the rules and regulations that go with it. That's my legal advice for you.
You can never say, like, I can never be like, oh, officer, I'm traveling.
You could say whatever you want, but
probably wouldn't work.
Yeah, if you don't have a license, you'll get arrested for operating without a license. Your car potentially could be impounded, particularly if it doesn't have insurance in Massachusetts, which is a requirement. And you're going to end up going to court. You're probably not going to go to jail, but you can pay lots of fines. So you might bankrupt yourself just because you were too lazy to go to the R&B.
I was wondering how that outlook ended up playing out, because I've seen a couple cases on TV where people would be like, oh, I'm a traveling officer. I'm not driving, I'm traveling. So there's a difference. Apparently in some kind of law or document, it says that traveling is a different passenger right than driving.
Have they ever won?
No.
There you go.
Probably never will either.
Nope. All right, I would like to finish. I would like to give you the test this weekend, but I have too much, so we will come back on Monday. We will finish up the information for the exam. Because what I want to do is I think...
Is it open notes?
You're going to be doing it at home on Blackboard.
Oh, all right, cool.
So I guess yes.
Yes, it is.
But of course, on the exam, you're only going to see one question at a time. It's going to be completely randomized. So good luck trying to find in your notes where it is, and then doing it without running out of time, because it's also time. Oh, and you can't go backwards.
What's the time limit on it?
I'll give you whatever the class is.
Okay.
Yeah, so this means your exam will be on Tuesday. All right. I'm good. I'm just having fun watching you all pack up.